Exactly.
I'm going to call this meeting of the Elections Committee to order. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum. So the first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes of our January 11th committee hearing. Do I have a member who would like to move approval of the minutes? Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the minutes, and I have a comment to make after that.
Sure. Is the comment regarding the minutes, or is it?
Somewhat directly. I just want to recognize that we have officially changed the membership of the committee.
Okay, sure.
Representative O'Driscoll is no longer a member, and Representative Quam has taken his place, and that, I understand, has been officially approved. And I just want to make sure the members of the committee are aware of that, and so that we all know who's here.
Yes, so the minutes, I believe, reflect the presence of Representative O'Driscoll. We will miss his insightful commentary. However, we will enjoy getting insightful commentary from Representative Quam, who is the new member of our committee. So thank you. So Representative Torkelson has moved approval of the minutes of the January 11th hearing. Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, we have approved the minutes. The first bill on the agenda is House File 117, Representative Stevenson's bill. Representative Stevenson, would you like to move your bill to be placed on the general register?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 117 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Okay.
Thank you. So Representative Stevenson has moved House File 117 to the general register. And I understand you have an A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment that gets the bill in the shape I'd like the committee to consider it.
Okay. Is there any discussion regarding the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, the amendment's adopted. The bill's in the shape you would like. Representative Stevenson, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in 2010, the United States Supreme Court opened the floodgates on campaign spending in its Citizens United decision. Court overturned decades of settled law, decimated our country's pretty much already weak campaign finance regime, and allowed practically unlimited campaign spending. A decade later, the results are in. They are not so good. Campaigns are absurdly expensive, and most of the spending is done by shadowy special interest groups as opposed to the candidates themselves or even political parties. Minnesotans are tired of that permanent campaign. They hate the flood of negative TV ads, negative mail, negative digital ads, and constant campaign activity. And I think they rightly think that huge corporations and the fabulously wealthy have oversized influence in our elections. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has taken away most of the tools in the toolbox the legislature has to regulate campaign spending. But there is one restriction that's still permissible under federal constitutional law. We can still restrict contributions and spending by foreign nationals. Minnesota law already does this for individuals, but doesn't address foreign corporations. The bill I am bringing before you today does just that. It's a relatively simple, straightforward bill that extends the existing prohibition on foreign nationals contributing to our campaigns and elections to foreign companies. I think it's well known or well thought that the Citizens United's decision stands for the proposition that corporations are people. And if that is the law, and people, foreign nationals can't contribute, foreign people can't contribute to our elections, it stands to reason that foreign corporations can't either. So that's the bill. I think there is some testimony, Mr. Chair. We had a video that we were hoping to play of a professor of constitutional law who was going to explain in a couple minutes what I was talking about the state of play on constitutional principles. But we unfortunately aren't able to get the audio to work this morning, I understand. And so I think that we will distribute that video to members via email. It's only 3 minutes long, and I think it's a good good explanation for the constitutional principles at work here. But, Mr. Chair, I understand there might be some additional testifiers.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Yes, our committee administrator, Mr. Brown, will send that video out to committee members. And I did watch that video. It is an insightful video, so I would encourage members to view it. So I have four people who have signed up to testify. The first on the list is Ken Peterson. If you could come forward, Mr. Peterson. And after Mr. Peterson will be Rich Graves. If you want to get ready to come down as well, that would be great.
Good morning. How are you?
So if you could keep your testimony to 3 minutes or so, that would be helpful. And welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Ken Peterson, and I'm a board member of the organization Clean Elections Minnesota. We're a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that supports fair elections in our state. We support House File 117 and urge you to support it, to vote for it. We think it would close a potentially dangerous loophole in our electoral system. I'm not going to talk about, as a supporting witness, I'm not going to go into the details of the of the Citizens United case or what this bill does with that. Rather, I want to talk about foreign influence and two different historic traditions in our in American history and what's going on here. First is, you know, throughout American history, we've been pretty open to foreign investment. The railroads were built with European and British money. We've always welcomed foreign investment, and the ideas continue today so that our number one selling beer, Budweiser, is owned by a Belgian company. 22% of the financial giant Morgan Stanley is owned by Mitsubishi in Japan. Uber is owned by, 5% of Uber is owned by Saudi Arabia. There's nothing wrong with that. Americans should welcome foreign investment, and American investors likewise should be able to invest in other nations. The free flow of capital makes our economic system function as well as it does and has worked for hundreds of years. But what is threatening, and I guess and historically it's been threatening to Americans, is when foreigners attempt to influence our democratic system. There's always been hostility to foreign involvement in our elections. And that's why both Minnesota law and federal law specifically forbids foreign nationals from contributing to U.S. campaigns. It's very clear. In 2011, in the case of Blumen versus the Federal Elections Commission, a three-judge federal appeals court panel, headed by now Justice Brett Kavanaugh, then Judge Kavanaugh, upheld the ban on political contributions from foreign individuals. Kavanaugh wrote that U.S. has a compelling interest in preserving self-governance, and I quote, and thereby prevent influence over the U.S. political process. A year later, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed with Judge Kavanaugh and upheld the decision. So it's very clear that we don't want foreign involvement in our elections. And using Justice Kavanaugh's straightforward logic, the state of Minnesota should extend that ban to foreign influence corporations, which this bill does. I learned yesterday that 40% of all stock in American companies is owned by foreigners, by foreign institutions, foreign individuals, that sort of thing. As I said earlier, we should not have a problem with that ownership, but we should ensure that foreign corporate ownership doesn't take away Americans' freedom to run their own government, to select their own leaders, and to make their own decisions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Peterson. Next on the list is Rich Graves, and after Rich Graves will be Ron Fine. Please come forward. Mr. Peterson, you may want to vacate the...
Yes, I would.
He's signing the...
I want to stay here all
day. Oh, gotcha.
Just feel happy here.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Rich Graves. I wasn't in a hurry. I'm Rich Graves. I'm here supporting Isaiah, Minnesota and HF 117.
Proceed.
My daughter was here for the YMCA Youth in Government 2 weeks ago. As we walk in the Capitol Rotunda, you see the showcases of the Civil War. Schools teach that this saved government of the people, by the people, for the people. Personally, I've worked in cybersecurity for 25 years in Minnesota and elsewhere with public trust and international partners. I've seen attacks on people, on American companies, and on democracy. I saw phishing, hacking, propaganda pitting neighbors against neighbors. As a security professional, there is no doubt that this occurred. As a person of faith, a couple of days after the MLK weekend, I hope we can agree that the interests of people should not be drowned out by influence operations. I've seen political violence. I have friends who were victims of torture in their home countries. In Minnesota, we have the Center for Victims of Torture. I've seen governments subverted, mostly in other countries. I'm not interested in seeing that here. Minnesotans have First Amendment rights. This includes their money, because money talks. Professionally, I've worked on audit and compliance issues in governance. In my experience, it is reasonable to ask big sources of money with interest in government policy to swear that they are not under undue influence. I'd like to be able to tell my kids that the state works for the people, not for the high bidder, especially if what the high bidder wants is for Minnesotans to fight each other. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Graves. Next on the list is Ron Fine, and after Ron Fine will be Matt Kinney. Is Ron Fine present? Okay, I'm not seeing him. Matt Kinney, you are up next. Once you've gotten to the table, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Matt Kinney. Good morning, Committee Chair Freiberg, Vice Chair Greenman, and members of the Elections Finance and Policy Committee. I live in St. Louis Park, and I'm here today to testify in support of House File 117, which would prohibit political activities by foreign influence corporations. I'd like to start with a couple of quotations that I'm sure you will recognize. The first is from the Declaration of Independence, and it's we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And the second one's from Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. The government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. In neither quote do you hear anything remotely like government for the corporations, or government for the wealthy, or government for the powerful. What I hear in these quotations is that our government is supposed to be about people, not corporations, not the wealthy, not the powerful. And it isn't just me who feels this way. When I was out door knocking last fall in support of candidates who shared my concern over the state of our democracy, I heard the same thing over and over again. Corporations and the wealthy have too much power compared to everyday people like me. This bill would start to give our elections back to the people. It would move us toward a system where every person has an equal say in our elections, closer to the system the founders of our nation intended. I urge you all to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. Several, actually. On your amendment, you changed the definition or the term owner to investor. Is there a percentage? I don't see investor listed as a definition. Is there a percentage of ownership that is considered an investor?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bliss, I think I'm going to find it in the where we line it up here, but what we're talking about is the percent of ownership stake that you have in the company. If you exceed 5%, then you qualify as a foreign influence corporation. So the threshold that you're looking for is 5%. And that there is a definition of foreign investor to your first question, but if you look to lines starting at 2.6, there's discussion of the threshold that creates a foreign influence corporation.
I think Mr. Gehring might have some comments to this point also. I see you nodding, so Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bliss, so on line 2.9, you see a standard of if it's a single foreign investor, the threshold is 1% of the total equity of the corporation, and on line 2.12, if there's two or more foreign investors in the corporation, the threshold is 5% of the total equity, and that's the definition that would then trigger the standard for the company being a foreign influence corporation.
So,
Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if a, for instance, I'm invested through multiple stock index funds, emerging Asia, emerging markets, European markets. I'm assuming England and all the rest of those investor markets has an emerging American stock market fund. Would that be, if they controlled 5% of on that fund, if they controlled 5% of the company or corporation in question, would they then be considered a foreign owner or investor?
Garing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bliss, I think under this definition, I would, if the foreign stock index fund holds 5% or more of the total equity of the corporation and there's two or more owners in that fund, then I think the answer is yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Stevenson.
And just, I think this is what, the key thing is who owns the fund, Mr. Chair, Representative Bliss. You know, the fact that there's a fund that exists in England that owns some American companies. It depends on who owns the fund. If it's owned by UK citizens, then yes.
Okay.
Representative Bliss.
Thank you. You made a nice presentation, and we should have had some threatening music playing when you're talking about the shadowy money and elections and all that. You know, I find it interesting that most of the dark money comes from PACs. And if I'm correct, they're nonprofits, some of them, especially, for instance, the George Soros funds are nonprofits, which are excluded if I read the bill correctly. Is that correct?
Representative Stevenson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bliss, I think that this is a really serious issue, and I don't think that it's inaccurate to say that there are shadowy organizations trying to influence the elections, and I think a lot of the PACs and super PACs that exist out there should have more transparency. I think there's more influence that these large corporations and super PACs have than they should. I also will note that the bill doesn't allow foreign influence corporations to make a contribution to any entity for the purpose of influencing an election. So I think it would include a lot of the activity you're talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a George Soros super fund that can contribute to a political action group here in Minnesota that wants to elect prosecutors, for instance, they did that in Arkansas. The sole contributor to that entity in Arkansas was the George Soros Fund, and it was a one issue entity that their sole goal was to elect prosecutors that would promote George Soros's philosophy. And if you want to talk about a dark money, I think George Soros would be the poster child for that dark money. So I would like to see this brought down to nonprofits. And I think the unions in Minnesota, the public sector unions, contribute far more to the Democrat Party than the Republican Party, and far more attack ads on the Republicans. And I know personally there's a lot of public school teachers, for instance, that don't appreciate their money being used for political campaigns. So the fact that this bill doesn't include PACs or nonprofits and unions troubles me a little bit.
Any additional member discussion? Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing this forward. I think at the end of the day, the heart of this issue is about transparency. And, you know, certainly there's a large difference between an American citizen exercising their right to free speech and a corporation who has foreign influence. And I really appreciate that Mr. Graves brought forward some of the very serious things that have been happening in the cyber world, in particular with the idea of foreign influence. This is a very real threat. Some of you may know that I a member of the new Legislative Commission on Cybersecurity, a member of the Technical Advisory Council from the governor. I've been in the IT industry for over 20 years, and I can tell you we have seen a steady increase in an attempt by foreign corporations and entities to interfere in our elections. And I think when we talk to people, everyday citizens, they don't need any deep dive and nitpicky piece to understand that we don't want foreign investment in our elections. We don't want foreign influence in our elections. And I think the average citizen understands that, they are clear on that, and they absolutely do not want it. And so I want to say thank you to Representative Stephenson for bringing this forward, because I think it is very clear by the voters that I spoke to that they want the voice of the people to ring true, not foreign corporations or investors. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do appreciate that the author indicated the legislative intent was corporations and other entities, which would be NGOs, PACs, and et cetera. So legislative intent are entities that have foreign funding flowing into them, which many NGOs have. And it would be nice to have that more explicitly evident in the bill, language-wise. The other thing I look at is that I remember a few years ago a announcement celebration that SEIU had a lot of non-American citizen members and activities. So therefore, my understanding from listening to the discussion here, from the testimony, from the members, and from the author, is that those are entities with, you know, foreign money going in, because if you're a non-American citizen and you're contributing into the dues, it's going into the political activities of the organization, and therefore that would be against the existing, you know, foreign individuals aren't allowed to contribute, but it also go against this bill, and be nice to have that included in this bill, because if we're going to straighten out the situation, then the partial narrow interpretation needs to be thrown out, and the complete interpretation, because it seems like the intent of the author is to include that no entity that's receiving foreign funds from foreign individuals, foreign corporations, should be involved in our elections. Therefore, NGOs, corporations, and unions are included in the scope of the intent. And I look forward to further clarification of the actual scope of this bill. Thank you.
Representative Stephenson, did you have a comment?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I just want to speak briefly to both Representative Quam and Representative Bliss' comments. First of all, just to be a lawyer here, if you look at the bill language, there's a definition of corporation, and a corporation includes both for-profit and not-for-profit entities. That's on line, starting lines 2.1, and that isn't even new law. That's just law in Minnesota. The second thing I would note is if you look at line if you look at the section subdivision 4A, starting on line 3.3, it says that a foreign influence corporation can't make a contribution to a political committee, political fund, or political party unit, or, and just to translate, political committee, political fund, that's what we call PACs in Minnesota law. So if you're concerned about PACs and super PACs, they're covered under this bill to the extent they're receiving funds from foreign influence corporations. So the concerns that you're articulating are within the bill, number one. Number two, I would go much further if I were king for a day. I would say we should not have nearly as much spending at all. And it's great to hear concern from both sides of the aisle about the level of expenditure in our elections. There is way too much. And I was impressed by how many times Representative Bliss was able to say George Soros' name in one answer. It's probably worth noting that I think Mr. Soros is an American citizen, but, you know, that's maybe neither here nor there. The point would be that I don't think that any individual, whether it's George Soros or I can't remember which Koch brother is still with us, but that person or any other fabulously wealthy person should not have the influence in our elections that they presently have today. Unfortunately, that's not a decision we get to make here at the Minnesota Legislature because of Supreme Court jurisprudence. The Supreme Court has gutted our ability to regulate money in elections. This is one narrow area where we have the ability to do something, and I think we should do it because it's something that we actually can do to deal with a problem that Minnesotans are really frustrated with. If you go out and talk to Minnesotans, they will tell you that there is way too much money being spent on our elections. And it's not just a nuisance. They don't like watching TV ads. But it's also a sense that the wealthy and the powerful on both sides of the aisle have way too much influence in our politics. This is not the perfect solution. I wish it was. But it's something we can do.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, since he was...
Follow-up, Representative Kwan.
Right. So I thought I heard... You know, for the record, the author of this bill indicating that PACs and therefore inclusive of unions would be in this prohibition. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kwan. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for this bill. As somebody who's been working on this issue as a campaign finance lawyer for a long time, I think it is helpful and important as we think about this bill and what we're doing moving forward about the tools we have to actually take on an issue I think we have all articulated we want to deal with. And when we think about why this can't apply to U.S. citizens, it is because of the or U.S. corporations, it is because of the Citizens United decision. This is one of the tools. The other tools we have are disclosure and transparency. And so I hope as we think about the tools we have to deal with the influx of large outside donors, we understand what Representative Stevenson is talking about, which is voters want to know who is spending money in their elections. Voters don't want to be influenced and have large influx of dark money coming from outside the country. And I think it's our obligation to use the tools we have, the limited tools that the Supreme Court has left us, to make sure that in Minnesota, the spending is both domestic and also fully disclosed and transparent. The disclosure we don't have here today, but I think that there's opportunities to work on what you, Representative Bliss, have been talking about, I think what Representative Kwan has been talking about. So I look forward to those further conversations as well.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify something because there have been several references to unions, and I want to clarify this because I'm not a lawyer, but sometimes I play one on TV. My understanding is that membership dues that are paid to unions for the purpose of providing the services that unions provide cannot be used on political activities. Am I correct on that? That was my understanding. I'm not a lawyer, but somebody who is can maybe answer that.
I'm looking for – it's a little beyond the scope of this bill. I'm looking for a hand.
Yeah.
If anyone wants to answer that. I don't know. I'm kind of looking at Representative Greenman.
we can move on if it's complicated, but that was my understanding, so I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Representative Torkelson, and then I'll go to Representative Stevenson for closing comments. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know which channel I should tune into to see Representative Coulter's acting abilities. But he did say he plays one on TV, so I assume there's a program out there where I can. For the author, when he's ready.
Just getting a pen. Go ahead.
First question, is this issue been in bill form before the legislature in past sessions?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes. I introduced it for the first time in 2020. I did reintroduce it last biennium, and then I reintroduced it this biennium. So this would be the third legislature that I've introduced this bill into.
Representative Torkelson?
Thank you. And did it get a hearing?
Representative Stevenson?
We were in discussions to have a hearing in 2020, and then the pandemic hit. I can't even recall if I requested a hearing last biennium. It did not.
Representative Torkelson?
Thank you. So we have an issue before us that has not been heard in committee prior to today. My question really is, how did you decide where to set the bar? And as I understand the bill, the proof of the certification of foreign ownership is put into the lap of the corporations. Is that correct? And then describe how you set the bar.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson. I'm not sure I quite understand the in the lap comment. As I think Mr. Gehring said, and as I said, there's a objective test that you can look at as to what constitutes a foreign influence corporation that starts on line 2.6 of the as introduced version of the bill, which says if there's one owner who controls more than 1% or two or more who control more than 5%, that it's a foreign influenced corporation. Those numbers, there's a study by the Business Roundtable that says that once you cross that 5% threshold, investors start to have real influence in the operations of the company. And so that's where that number comes from.
Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, 5% seems rather arbitrary, but the in the lap comment has to do with line 3.2, certification of compliance with subdivision 4A.
Which line? I'm sorry.
3.2.
I have a different 3.2.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This was in my packet.
3.2 for me just says red.
Yeah, I have the
subdivision 4B.
3.20.
Oh, I'm sorry, 3.20. I haven't been around here very long.
Representative Stevenson?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, what subdivision 4B on line 3.20 says that when corporations make contributions, they have to certify that they are not a foreign influence corporation under this section with the Campaign Finance Board. So when Representative Greenman's talking about transparency, that's what we're talking about. That it makes it clear and it provides a record so that regulators and the public can challenge that attestation that they're not a foreign influence corporation.
Representative Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, Representative Stevenson. So, you know, with this percentage line that's being drawn in the sand, ownership of some corporations, I would imagine, is a somewhat dynamic issue, depending on investors come, investors go. Some of them may be foreign, some of them may be not foreign. It seems that it really puts a burden on the corporation to try and figure out on a virtually daily basis whether they're foreign owned or not, if you're close to that threshold. And if you're over it, you are subject to the penalties of this legislation. Can you elaborate on that, or is it we just looking at this is the perfect number we've discovered and we know it's the right percentage?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I think it's important to have an objective standard, okay? I think there should be a number. 5% makes sense to me. If you were to have brought an amendment raising it to 7 or decreasing it to 3, we could have had a conversation about that. I'm not saying that that's, you know, ordained in the stars, that it should be 5%. But it makes sense to me. It has a basis in that at 5%, the business community tells us that investors start to have real influence in the operations of a company. So that's one issue that you raise. The second issue you raise is this compliance issue about, you know, if you have a company that's teetering on the edge of 5, can they make a contribution or not? And, you know, it would depend on what they are at the time they want to make the contribution, and it is a compliance obstacle that a company that's in that specific circumstance would be in. But I hardly think that's a reason to not restrict foreign money in our U.S. elections is that there might be some compliance difficulties. I think that Minnesotans are tired of the large amounts of money in our politics, and I don't really see that as a reason to not proceed. You know, at the point where you're going to have an objective standard, when you get close to it, it's going to get tricky.
Representative Torkelson, maybe final follow-up. We do have two other bills on the agenda.
I'll try to make it my final. So then the last question is, should this legislation have been in place in the last election cycle, what would have been the impact?
Somewhat speculative, but if you have any thoughts, Representative Stevenson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, well, I think it's entirely speculative because part of the problem we have is that we don't know where these companies are spending their money right now because we don't have enough disclosure and transparency in our election law, and I hope that Representative Greenman and others, and myself included, will work on that. So I don't know how much less would have been spent. It could be a lot, could be a whole lot. Who knows? There's too much money out there that we aren't able to track at all. We have no idea where the money comes from or where it goes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill does seem to be a bit of a solution looking for the right problem, but we'll continue the discussions down the road.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Representative Stevenson, any closing remarks?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll just be brief. I think the problem of overspending in our elections is a very real one that the overwhelming majority of Minnesotans see. I wish we had more tools in the toolbox to address it. I wish the Supreme Court had not adopted a series of cases that empower the fabulously wealthy and huge corporations to dominate our elections. But that is the world that we are living in at the moment. And this is the best tool we have in the toolbox at the moment. So I ask members to vote yes.
With that, Representative Stevenson renews his motion that House File 117 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion carries. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. And if you could stay up there, Representative Stevenson, we have another one of your bills. Representative Stevenson, would you like to move that House File 451 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
Mr. Chair, that is my motion. I move House File 451 be placed on the general register.
Thank you. And I understand you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move that and provide any description?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move the A1 amendment, which is an author's amendment, getting the bill in the shape I'd like the committee to consider it in.
Any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment's adopted. The bill's in the shape you would like. Representative Stevenson, please describe your bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House File 451 concerns the order on which candidates are listed on the ballot in partisan races. So in Minnesota presently, we have two systems for determining the order that candidates appear on the ballot, one for nonpartisan races and one for partisan races. In nonpartisan races, we do the correct thing, the thing that makes sense. We determine a random order of candidates, and then we rotate it precinct by precinct. So if there are two candidates in a race, in precinct one, candidate A appears first and candidate B appears second. In precinct two, candidate B appears first and candidate A appears second. Precinct three, we're back to candidate A and candidate B. That makes sense. It's fair. It's random. It's probably the best we can do. For partisan races, we do something entirely different, and I'm at a loss to understand, frankly, why. I've tried to dig into it. I'm not really sure why we started doing this, but I don't think it makes any sense. What we do is we list the candidates by their major party in reverse order for how the major party did at the top of the ticket in the last election. So the worst performing party in the last election gets to go first in every partisan race on the ballot and going down from there. It's almost as if we're trying to put a thumb on the scale on behalf of the party that didn't do as well in the last election. And the reason why I say that is that there's a lot of studies out there, a lot of statistical research that shows, unfortunately, the order in which candidates' names are printed on the ballot is of consequence in an election. So one study in the state of Ohio, showed that the candidate who appears first in a legislative election on the ballot benefited to the tune of 2 to 3%. versus the candidate who appeared second. There's an older study from Texas in 2000 that showed that then candidate Bush, the man who became President Bush, his vote share varied by almost 10 points depending upon whether he was first on the ballot or last. That's kind of incredible. Our election should not be determined by how we print the ballot. It should be determined by voters. So I think this is a pretty common sense bill that tries to level the playing field and makes it so that one party isn't advantaged over another just by the way that we print the names on the ballot.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. We did not have anybody sign up to testify on this bill. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's like you, I've been unable to really decipher the history of this particular provision in Minnesota statute. Any idea how long this particular practice has been in place?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, and I don't know, I asked this question of Mr. Gehring, and we weren't able to come up with any reason why, and I don't know if he had any, it sounds like nothing further. So no, we don't know why or how or when. Doesn't make any sense to me.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Well, if Matt Gehring doesn't know, nobody knows.
Right.
In my experience, anyway. We can only make assumptions, you know, and I think your assumption is probably correct that the authors of this sort of statute were trying to give emerging parties a chance to gain more recognition. Even if they can't win an election, they at least people would notice that they're out there, whether it's the Independent Party or other minor parties that are involved in Minnesota politics. But it's from a fairness perspective, it's hard to argue against your bill. So I have nothing more to say.
Thank you, Representative Ferguson. Representative Plum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my recollection is that there have been periods in Minnesota where people have been upset with the two major parties, and they've wanted, you know, something else, and that there have been efforts periodically to have newer, different parties. And I think here's me guessing the legislative intent behind the original was to show that in fairness, they were trying to make it easier for the smaller, at least you had to go by and read the names, and you'd realize that there are alternatives to the big two. And, that is a judgment call. I understand your position, but every time I look at maybe changing an existing, I try really hard to understand what went into, is there something I'm missing? And I came up with the only thing to me was that at least, you know, these minority parties were getting top billing so that people would be aware there are alternatives. And if there are alternatives and the big two still win, then maybe there's more confidence that it's a, you know, level or fair playing field for people that don't agree with the major parties. And that's not meant to lobby for or against this bill. It's just that it's always good for us to wonder what was the situation that caused this, because there are times we look at a statute and say, what were they thinking? You know, but thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Just to your point, Representative Stevenson, as I read the bill, especially with the adoption of the amendment that we put in there, I think your bill would actually make it more likely that minor parties receive greater recognition, because if you notice, the amendment we adopted repealed Subdivision 3, which states that minor parties actually go on the ballot after the major parties. So under your bill now, minor parties would actually be rotated in at the same amount and appear at the top of the ballot as frequently as the minor parties, if they're assuming there is a minor party in the race. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you, and you're exactly right. I kind of did not get into the weeds of that when I was describing the bill, and I probably should have, that our current law is a little bit more complex on the partisan races in that it prioritizes major parties over minor parties. So the major parties always appear first in the manner in which I described, followed by the minor parties. And this bill ends that, and all of the candidates get rotated. Their order is determined randomly and then rotated. That, incidentally, also has the effect of making this a very easy bill for the Secretary of State's office to implement with no cost, which is part of the reason why we're doing it that way.
Thank you. Any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Stevenson?
I think it's a common sense bill. I ask for a yes vote. I renew my motion.
Yep. Representative Stevenson renews his motion that House File 451, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Thank you, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you.
Representative Bonner. So Representative Bonner has House File 205. While she proceeds to the table, Representative Bonner, I'm assuming you would like to move that House File 205 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Is that your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my motion.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bonner. And I understand you also have an A3 amendment. Would you like to move that and provide any description?
I do, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment makes some additional changes from the last time this bill came forward to add additional clarity to make sure that we are making sure that this references items that are, in fact, on the ballot, and so that we are not necessarily indicating that someone should keep a catalog of things from previous elections, but simply the current items on the ballot that day. It also clarifies a minor point about absentee voting locations as well.
Thank you. Any discussion to the amendment? All right, seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment's adopted. The bill's in the shape you would like. Representative Bonner, please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I want to thank you all, of course, for the opportunity to bring HF 205 before you here today. For Minnesotans, our nation leads in voter participation. And I can attest to the belief that voting is a sacred obligation in our civic duty. Its execution is taken with the utmost care to be conducted with dignity, decorum, and sanctity. Exercising the right to vote or choosing is a time for citizens to make their voices heard through the ballot. After a long season of campaigning, countless hours of persuading voters and soliciting their vote, voters have done their homework. They have mulled their decision. They are done with campaigning. And they are ready to vote. In June of 2018, the Supreme Court heard Minnesota Voters Alliance versus Mansky, in which the courts upheld the right of states to designate sanctuary free from influence within the polling place. The court majority made clear that states can reasonably restrict some forms of advocacy and restrict apparel to prevent intimidation, provided it has clear and workable standards. Specifically, Justice Roberts wrote in his decision, "Casting a vote is a weighty civic act, akin to a jury's return of a verdict or a representative's vote on a piece of legislation. It is a time for choosing, not campaigning." He went further. "The state may reasonably decide that the interior of the polling place should reflect that distinction, and states can give the voter the opportunity to exercise their civic duty in a setting removed from the clamor and din of electioneering. However, they did take issues with portions of the Minnesota state statute, suggesting that the language lacked clarity with concise, objective, and workable standards for poll workers and election judges. The bill before you takes into account the guidance of the justices by a careful review of examples deemed as the gold standards by the justices, scouring the language and creating the best of breed approach. Created in consultation with the Secretary of State, as well as legal consultation on election law, the bill creates a more comprehensive prohibition, clarifying what is permitted and what is not, and to be more crisp, while limiting the scope to make sure it is more easily interpreted by poll workers, election judges, and ordinary citizens. It also balances the sanctity of the polling place upheld by the Supreme Court with the right of individuals to free speech and its expression. I have with me here today the Secretary of State Simon to testify on behalf of the bill, and Nicole Freeman, the Government Relations Director with the Office of the Secretary of State.
Welcome to the committee, Secretary Simon. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Thank you to Representative Bonner for bringing forward the bill. I think there are two, in my judgment, two reasons to support this bill. One is general and one is specific. The general reason is this is the kind of cleanup that I think it's good for the legislature to do regularly. What Representative Bonner is responding to with her bill is a Supreme Court case that is nearly 5 years old, and yet the statute that's on the books does not reflect what the court did and what the court said. And that's an issue for our constituents, I think, all of us. What's on the written page of the statute books doesn't tell you how courts may have altered its effect. So Mr. and Mrs. Minnesota are looking up in the statutes and trying to figure out, you know, they're not lawyers, they're not legislators, but they're trying to figure out, what can I wear to the polling place? What's in and what's out? And what they see before them is a case that's been a statute that's been dramatically altered 5 years ago by the U.S. Supreme Court. So whether a person agrees or disagrees with what the Supreme Court did, they really did limit Minnesota statute significantly. And so I think it's important to put in place statutory language that reflects the current state of the law. Otherwise, it's really misleading for our constituents. The second more specific reason is that I think what Representative Bonner has come up with is a narrowly tailored way to effectuate the things that she's talked about, as Chief Justice Roberts and many other federal courts have said. In fact, one phrase that really sticks out with me is that federal courts have routinely said that voters are entitled to an oasis of calm in a polling place. That's kind of soothing. An oasis of calm, that it's okay for the state to regulate speech in the polling place for that reason. There's a compelling interest to do that. But what the court said in the Mansky case was the Minnesota statute went too far. The Minnesota statute said that you can't wear anything, I'm barely paraphrasing here, but the statute that's currently on the books says you can't wear anything that's political. And the court said that's way, way, way too broad. What does that even mean? It requires election judges to have in their mind a catalog of slogans and designs and all the rest. For example, what if someone went into the polling place with a shirt that said, "I'm with her," or "Let's go, Brandon," or whatever? I mean, it's unworkable, because a particular election judge might not know those things. They might not know, slogans and the like. And so what Representative Bonner has done, I think quite sensibly, is modernize the Minnesota statute to reflect what the Supreme Court said the state can do, which is the state can, it strongly implied, ban apparel in the polling place that pertains to the election going on that day. And so the prevailing interpretation of what the Supreme Court allowed is that it's okay for the state to say you can't wear apparel that has a slogan or a likeness or a depiction of someone or something on the ballot that day. Vote yes on the school board referendum, or the ballot question. You can't have a hat or a shirt that says that. Or last fall, you couldn't walk in with a Scott Jensen T-shirt or a Tim Walz T-shirt, but you could walk in with a Mark Dayton T-shirt or a Tim Pawlenty T-shirt, because they're not on the ballot that day. So I think what her bill does sensibly is what the Supreme Court said states could do. You can limit speech. You can create that oasis of calm and the absence of electioneering by banning likenesses or depictions of someone on the ballot that day. And that narrow way of doing things is what the Supreme Court said was okay. So both from the standpoint of just cleaning up the statute books to reflect the current state of the law and the particular policy choices that Representative Bonner have made, which I think is consistent with what the legislature has done for decades, regardless of who's in control. Let's maintain that oasis of calm. Let's make sure that we don't have people campaigning and electioneering in the polling place. But if someone wants to put on something that's political that doesn't pertain to someone on the ballot that day and that isn't explicitly so, then that's okay.
Thank you, Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Are there any members of the public who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was thinking maybe the interpretation of the Secretary would be useful. But from the author, presidential logo and attire in a non-presidential election year, your bill would not affect that. In other words, you'd still be allowed to wear, as the Secretary of State stated, Pawlenty or, you know, candidates that were quite visible and have name recognition but weren't on the ballot.
Representative Bonner.
It would be restricted to anyone who is on the ballot in that specific election, whether it is a presidential year or a non-presidential year. It is specific to anything on the ballot in that specific election.
Well, I was,
that is the language of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping for a no. We wouldn't prohibit presidential stuff in a non-presidential election year. I thought that was, you know, yeah. Straightforward on that, but
apologies, Mr. Representative Quam. I may have misunderstood your question. Yes, if they are not on the ballot, then yes, it would be allowed. If they are on the ballot in that specific election, it would not be allowed.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I have heard from people that wore red hats with a slogan on it, which didn't have a candidate's name, in the last election, or a shirt with a similar slogan, were told they couldn't vote with those on. So I just wanted to make sure that was on the record so that people would know. What about if there is a constitutional amendment in regards to gun rights or gun ownership, and somebody wears a Second Amendment shirt on that is basically just straight Second Amendment, isn't talking to the specifics or details, because I think that was the actual attire that brought this case about.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Representative Quam, Mr. Chair. If it is not on the ballot or pertaining to a specific ballot question or candidate on the ballot, then it is permissible.
Mr. Chair, the question was, if there's a constitutional amendment with gun restrictions as being the topic, would a person be able to wear a Second Amendment shirt, especially considering that the actual attire that was before the Supreme Court had to do with a Second Amendment shirt being worn in Minnesota? So on an election where there is on the ballot a gun restriction, would you be able to wear a constitutional Second Amendment shirt? Or would this bill prohibit it?
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Quam, I mean, it is somewhat speculative. I mean, it would need to, you know, we'd need to know, like, exactly what the shirt said and how closely it tied to the item the amendment that was on the ballot, but Representative Bonner.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, if the subject of that attire or material does pertain to something that is directly on a ballot, whether it is a ballot question, whether it is a candidate, whether it is an amendment on the ballot, then yes, the statute would apply. And I think it's, it looks like Mr. Gehring may have a comment as well. Would is that accurate?
Like to weigh in, Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I think I would just point out on the amendment that was adopted, the A3, the prohibition applies if the item displays the number, title, subject, slogan, or logo of a ballot question that appears on the ballot. So then the question would be, is the T-shirt that the person is wearing related to the subject of the ballot question, or does it have a slogan related to the ballot question? And if that is the case, then this bill would prohibit it. But if that's not the case, if it's not related to the subject of the ballot question, then this bill would not prohibit it.
Mr. Chair, the big thing is maybe clarifying related to, because if I wear a shirt that has the, the Constitution on it, and it's got, and it has the amendments, that is obviously related to gun rights, or if the thing was free speech, then I couldn't wear anything that referenced the U.S. Constitution on free speech. I think it's a messy area, and I only brought it up because the likelihood that something in election might be related to the Second Amendment is reasonable to expect possibility, and the fact that that exact attire was the subject of the, U.S. Supreme Court decision. The last question I go over is, you've got in here in your amendment exhibit. Well, if I have a phone and I'm going through social media, it is quite possible that some media, either visual or audible, on that phone might have a slogan, a song associated with, pictures. I could be going through Facebook and I've got a picture of a cousin with in a parade, or wearing a shirt. So I have exhibiting on my phone media that would be in violation here. How does this bill handle that? Because I don't see it explicitly detailing except for on a phone, or except for that's not visible or audible to people around. Because you could be standing in a line. I've stood in a voting line for quite an extensive period of time, some years. So I'm just trying to get clarification, because I don't see it clearly addressed in the bill.
Just one comment before hand it over to Representative Bonner. I did just pull up the definition of the word exhibit on Merriam-Webster.com, and it says to show or display outwardly, especially by visible signs or actions. So I guess it would depend if the person is showing their phone.
But Mr. Chair, to that subject, I think all of us have been waiting in lines, and you can hear the other person's phone thing, and it is not unreasonable. You might be bored looking around, and to think that somebody wouldn't see, notice if they're standing next to you, and I'm not sure if the state law says that we use definitions from Webster, or we actually in a bill put a definition for clarity.
Any comment, Representative Bonner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Quam. I certainly would like to think that most folks in line are focused on the task at hand, but I certainly appreciate that they may have longer than average wait times in some locations, particularly on election day, since Minnesota does have such high voter participation, which is, of course, a wonderful issue to have here in Minnesota and quite honestly a point of pride. But that said, I do feel like exhibit is a pretty standard definition and term. Even here, when it speaks directly in the definition to outwardly displaying, I would assume that if you are scanning your phone because you are bored, that you are not running around waving your phone at people and that it is for your consumption. So I would have to assume that any reasonable person would believe that that was not exhibiting.
I have been in at voting and had people that weren't quite as well, I should say that are openly and actively not following the law. So I don't think it's unreasonable to think that there will be situations where somebody might be playing something for the purpose of affecting and influencing. So I just would like any election bill we do needs to be thought out, well-defined, because especially one caused by a court case which overturned previous statute, that we need to be thorough and avoid situations. And that's why I brought up the difference between, oh, we look it up in Webster's, or, gee, we have bills that actually define and clarify. And so when we do election bills, I want to make sure it's clear and well-defined in the bill. And that's why I bring up the author's intent for legislative intent, because there are, if it goes to a court case, what was the intent is important. And why do I say it in a televised committee meeting? Well, so the public understands that we thoroughly look at what could possibly be involved. And there are people that aren't comfortable with the election. I want them to feel comfortable. And so if we actually discuss and talk about, I think that is making it transparent that we are thinking about all this content. But thank you.
Yeah, thank you. At the risk of prolonging this discussion, I mean, just for there are, you know, it is, you know, we do rely somewhat on common understanding of words. I mean, not every word in a bill can be described. We actually have a canons of construction chapter of the Minnesota statutes. It's 645.08, and it does say words and phrases. You know, when you're interpreting the statutes of the state, which this would be, words and phrases are construed according to rules of grammar and according to their common and approved usage. So, you know, I don't think that a definition is necessary there, but because of provisions like that. So, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bonner. And I think from this discussion, it's the oasis of calm, I think, was the term, especially in this political environment. It's a place where this bill and what you're getting at, I think, provides a really clean and crisp rule that thinks about all voters. I'm wondering if you could just describe a little bit about if someone does come with one of these T-shirts, what happens then? Are they able to vote?
Representative Bonner.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenman, and thank you for that excellent question. Yes, the voter would still be permitted to vote. And I think we should not put any barriers in place of an eligible voter upon their ability to actually cast their ballot. And so, yes, in fact, it would still allow this individual to vote. The Secretary of State has also issued guidance for poll workers and election judges on the day of that also makes clear that that individual does have the right to cast their ballot and should be allowed to do so.
Member discussion. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. So the bill affects, of course, absentee voting, and bans these practices within 100 feet of the building in which polling is taking place. In many cases, I believe that polling places adjacent to or in the same building as many other governmental services. During the period of absentee voting, which can be broadened, it seems to me it'd be very easy for someone to unintentionally come to that building wearing something related to the campaign with no intention of affecting other voters, but would be affected by this legislation. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lee Turkelson. I believe the language of the bill also does clarify that it is only applies during voting hours, for one, because I do know that there are sometimes other uses for a building outside of those voting hours. There may be activities in that building, say, in an evening after hours have concluded or things like that. And certainly, this would certainly not apply after that time period or when voting is actually actively happening in that space. That said, also, to be clear, I think 50 to 100 feet is, in my estimation, not a great distance. but certainly, I think it is sufficient enough to maintain that oasis of calm that we are after here. The idea is not to restrict people's ability to express themselves or their freedom of speech, but certainly to allow for a area of sanctuary, that oasis of calm, for voters to actually be able to cast their ballot. That is the intent of the bill, and I feel that the bill is fairly clear on that particular position.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the oasis of calm, as I understand the bill, applies to the entire building. And if the building supplies other services to citizens in addition to a polling place, doesn't this create some unusual restrictions?
Representative Bonner.
Do we have someone from the Secretary of State who'd like to weigh in on this?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State, Government Relations Director. I think I would like to answer it based on sort of our current guidance and what we tell our counties and cities right now. Currently, the guidance would be particularly for the area where the voting is occurring in, say, a county government center, that the area where the voting is occurring is sort of the location that needs to be sort of the sanctuary of calm. It does lead to interesting scenarios, though, where it would have to be considered on a case-by-case basis. And I think some of that then is left up for interpretation.
I guess, thank you, Ms. Freeman.
Yeah.
At one point I'd make, too, is this language related to 100 feet of a building is in the existing law on line 1.9 of the bill also. Although
correct.
That law has had some issues because of the Supreme Court decision, but at least that was the standard which we used prior to that decision. Is that an accurate statement?
That's correct, and I think our current, like I said, our current guidance is that it would impact 100 feet of the building, and I think our current guidance directs city clerks and county officials to look at the area where voting is occurring. But depending on the layout of the building and entrances and things like that, it could lead to situations, and I know from personal experience it's led to situations where folks are asked to turn things inside out or remove a button or something as they might be entering a location that hypothetically also is a driver's license location, but also is serving as, and there's one central entrance. There are times where modifications might have to be made or a request for that modification is made upon someone entering. And I think the guidance from the Office of the Secretary of State is to try to focus that as much as possible into the area that is where people are voting.
Representative Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Representative Freiberg. So it sounds like it's kind of up to interpretation is the way I'm interpreting your remarks, that it is not within 100 feet of the building. It's something that's not quite so well defined.
Ms. Freeman?
Mr. Chair and members, I think currently that's our interpretation right now, and this bill could clarify that further.
Torkelson, any follow-up?
Well, I don't see how it clarifies it further because we're using the same language over again.
Nicole Freeman, or any additional comment?
I think that the question. The goal, like I said, if there's a, what I should clarify is if there's entrances or common areas, those are where, you know, we sort of in the past have asked folks to use their best judgment to try to provide that sanctuary of calm within 100 feet of the building, I think does still apply in that we, I think that it currently would be interpreted by local and city, county and city officials, serving absentee locations that someone couldn't hold a campaign rally in their parking lot, for example. That sort of activity would be prohibited. And I think the maybe discretion that I'm describing is sort of the level of we've been asked, you know, for all entrances at our building, do we need to have someone standing there checking for political apparel? And I think that the instance I described is sort of a very specific case where there was only one entrance, and so it would be appropriate to make sure that that oasis of calm was preserved.
Representative Torkelson.
So thank you. So if I show up, say absentee voting is open and I am there to get my driver's license renewed and I show up with my t-shirt, my campaign t-shirt on, and I'm on the ballot, I will be asked to, well, whatever the action is, to turn my t-shirt inside out or whatever that is. That's the way it is.
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think that would be based on our current interpretation of the court and I think our reading of this bill, that would be the request that would be made.
Well, thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
I'll leave that topic as is. The other thing I'm curious about is the slogan, the word slogan. You know, there's a variety of words that are used as campaign slogans. Some of them seem to be very specific to a campaign. Others are more general in nature. How is that language, the term slogan, going to be interpreted?
Representative Bonner.
First, I just did want to make a clarification on the polling place and the distances. It should be noted that 49 out of 50 states do have limitations around distances around a polling location. 48 of them have distances. One is limited to the building. There's only one state in the union that does not actually have those prohibitions in place. And I should also note that that particular piece of the court case was not in dispute. There were no challenges to that portion. The portion that the courts had issue with was making sure that there were workable and objective standards on understanding what was permitted within that polling place and what was not to the specific points of, you know, distances within a polling place or the building itself. And so just want to make that clarification that the court had no issue with that and did actually uphold those pieces. And then in terms of the slogan, I think, you know, we also wanted to make sure that we confined the scope so that we, you know, making someone have that mental inventory, right, of historical information on candidates or their logos and all of that, and made it specific and brought down the scope of this bill to confine it only to those items that are specifically on the ballot in that election, making it much more simple and easy for folks to understand what it is. Now, I would argue that the few items or candidates who do have, for example, a slogan, which many of them do not, but those that do tend to be pretty recognizable. I don't think there is anyone in this room for whom we could say the word MAGA, and they do not understand what that means. That is clearly a slogan. It has been for some time and is very well understood. But I think, again, we have confined the scope to be specific to just the items on the ballot at a specific time frame, so that we do not need to ask election judges or poll workers to keep a historic reference of every slogan, every logo, or every candidate throughout history, simply confining it to a very specific place and time and manner.
Representative Torkelson, any final follow-up? Okay, seeing none. Okay. Any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks? Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will just finish with this. I think Minnesotans do review voting as a very solemn oath, a sacred trust. They do appreciate the time and the care that we take to give them as much information as possible leading up to an election. But when it, as Supreme Court Justice Roberts stated, when you get to that polling place, it is a time for choosing, not a time for campaigning. And I think Minnesotans agree with that statement, that they want to have that sense. And we have seen in recent times that sometimes we live in a very politically charged environment where people feel very passionately, and perhaps that is good to have those passions. But when we get into the polling place, I think there's a reasonable expectation that we want that oasis of calm. We want to be free from campaigning. We want to be free from influence. We simply want to go in to exercise our sacred duty and to be able to vote. And I think that this bill really makes it a much more crisp version of the current law. It also takes into account the preferences that justices stated for what they preferred in other states, and including the gold standards that they held up to truly create more of a best of breed approach to this particular issue. We've also narrowed the scope to make it more specific and easily to interpret for election workers, for poll workers, election judges, and for citizens. And I think that is really the intent, and it is in line with what the justices had intended for this particular piece of statute. And with that, I would ask members to vote in favor.
Representative Bonner renews the motion that House File 205, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Your bill is on its way. Thank you, members, for a lively discussion. Seeing no additional comments, this meeting is adjourned.